we got the alternative energy. Right. And we kill our free autonomy.
And welcome to the Radioactive Show, produced at the studios of 3CR Melbourne and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the Radioactive Show. I'm Michaela, and today on the program we're looking at critical minerals and rare earth mining with Liz Downs and Lee Tan. Liz Downs is a campaigner, researcher, writer, and currently director of the Rainforest Information Centre. In recent times, Liz has been focused on working with local communities in Ecuador who are resisting Australian mining extractive interests. She is leading the AidWatch research to map Australia's so-called green extractivism footprint domestically and internationally. Lee Tan is a social researcher with decades of health, environmental, and social justice campaign experience, ranging from grassroots activism to policy advocacy at the multilateral institutional level. She worked as Asia Pacific campaign coordinator for the Australian Conservation Foundation and has established links with Indigenous communities, local organisations, and national organisations in the region. Lee leads the AidWatch campaign Stop Linus. Liz, would you like to start by giving us a bit of an overview of what is happening with critical minerals and rare earth mining? It's obviously becoming a very significant issue all around the globe, and I'd love for you to start by painting us a bit of a picture of what's happening.
Yeah, so the project that I'm sort of starting to pull together for AidWatch is a mapping project that's focused on Australian companies and Australian projects. And just over maybe 3 or 4 years ago, there were hardly anything in terms of rare earth projects popping up in Australia or about anywhere that was outside of China. And the only exception was Linus Rare Earths, which Lee will obviously talk about in more depth. So Linus was really like cornering the global market in rare earths outside of China. And then about, 4 years ago or so, with, you know, the rush to diversify from China, and in particularly in rare earths, which had such a supply bottleneck, of course, you know, there were all these mining companies going, well, we can start exploring for these things in other places and make money. So with Australia, Australia's been pretty much in the lead of some of these rare earth pushes for opening up explorations and developing projects, both globally and domestically in Australia. To the point now where we've got globally 69 projects. Well, I've got 69 projects on the database. It might be a little bit more that I haven't found yet. That are owned by Australian companies, and 37 of these are domestically on Australian soil. Most of those are in kind of early exploration, but we've got about 3 projects in development, and they're getting like really quite heavy investment from the main agency being the federal government under things like critical minerals, strategic reserve policies, the Australian Critical Minerals Prospectus, which was opened in February this year, or updated in February this year, and also bilateral trade agreements, especially with the US and also with countries like Japan. So we've got these developments going on. And the main 3, Arafura Resources has a project called the Nolans Project in the Northern Territory, only a little bit north of Alice Springs near Aileron, which, you know, is quite a sensitive area. It's surrounded by Aboriginal lands. It's got, you know, sensitive water area. We've got Iluka Resources, which is going to build a refinery in Western Australia, and Hastings, which has also got a heavy rare earth mine in West Australia. And then we've got a bunch of ones in Victoria near Horsham. Yeah, so it's kind of exploding. And yeah, there's various issues already, like, you know, concerns from communities around what's going to happen to radioactive waste. Is it going to be stored safely on site? Is it going to affect waterways and all that sort of thing? So on the global impacts, we're probably mainly in Africa, and we've got a few projects in Brazil, and some of these exploration projects are already causing community concerns and community impacts. in those areas as well.
These are being pushed as being really important for green energy and new technologies, but we know obviously they're very significant for use in military technology as well. Could we talk a little bit about that tension there between them being promoted as being necessary for green energy revolution and actually the environmental impacts at the mine site and, of course, at the processing plants as well?
Yeah, well, basically, initially, back in the 2010, when companies like Lynas started to set up its rare earth processing plant in Malaysia, it was pitched as a green tech, you know, kind of renewable energy critical mineral. But since then, due to the current geopolitical tension, you know, starting from US and China having its trade war towards the end of the Biden administration in the USA, and of course, you know, in recent years as Trump took over presidency in the US, military tensions gone to the, you know, the current chaotic heights. And yeah, and US suddenly realized that these critical minerals, rare earth included, has been in the monopoly of the Chinese kind of industry. They basically almost control the whole supply chain, from mining right to the downstream processing to the end products. And that includes military hardware. And because of that, you know, the militarization of this mineral took over. I mean, at this stage, we hope anyway, there hasn't been any violent confrontation over minerals. But you know, as we can see with the oil situation, Israel and all that, there's already been wars waged. Yeah, and, you know, part of it is because of the oil and gas. In some way, that means that we should really move away from fossil fuels so that hopefully we can have less tension. But then from our own experience from the ground, it's not going to be like that. In the case of Lynas, I mean, you have this company that promoted itself to be a critical rare earth supplier outside of China. And it is true, but in reality, it actually produced only a small percentage. I'm not sure if it is like 10% of the world demand for rare earth. So it's kind of quite insignificant. There's a lot of pressure for other rare earth resource-rich country to exploit their rare earth minerals as well. And that went as far as Sweden, where I think an Australian company, exploration company, was looking at opening up one in one of the Swedish kind of regional center. And interestingly, the early days discovery of rare earth actually started in Northern Europe, and Sweden was one of them. And anyway, now in the case of Lynas again, we have this company that has set up a secondary processing plant in Malaysia. Its mine is situated in Mount Weld in Western Australia, which is about, I think, about 600 kilometres inland from Perth. They concentrate the rare earth from the mineral deposit they dug out from open cast mining, and then it's got sent to the Port of Fremantle for export to Malaysia for the second stage of the processing. Although Lynas now has a plant in Kalgoorlie doing almost exactly the same as what its Malaysian plant's doing, except that the Kalgoorlie plant has had many problems with interrupted water supply, power supply, and also, you know, strong opposition from local people over water. And because of that, this company is now forcing the Malaysian plant to accept more of its rare earth mineral, which is termed lanthanide concentrate. yet to process it there. The problem is this particular mineral has contained radioactive materials, thorium and uranium. I'm sure you're quite familiar with that, working with the uranium campaign in Australia. And both of them are long-living radioactive hazards for local people where they are stored. And since 2010, there's been strong opposition in Malaysia to accept the radioactive waste and also the pollution from Lynas. And on top of that too, the use of water, huge amount of water from the local supply. And there's, you know, like almost weekly, monthly water disruption to the public in Malaysia, or at least in the township of Kuantan or city of Kuantan. I mean, that wouldn't be possible in Kalgoorlie. You have residents jumping up and down. Whereas Malaysians been told lies by the government that it was repair here and there, whatever, that interrupted the water. But in reality, it's actually water supply being cut to supply liners for the rare earth processing. Yeah, and of course, Malaysia also supply a huge amount of power to Lynas at very low cost. And in terms of climate change, I mean, initially back in the 2010s and whatever, when Lynas claimed itself to be a green mineral production hub, it was claiming that it's a solution for climate change and this and that, and then we have to accept it. But in reality, these palming emissions from Australia to Malaysia, because rare earth processing require huge amount of energy for that, and then it sends out huge amount of emissions into the atmosphere, and also the pollution, the air pollution, the wastewater pollution, Worst of all is the radioactive waste, and we're talking about huge quantity in the millions of tons.
Wow.
For every ton of, I just saw this today, some calculation. For example, one of the waste, they're not classified as radioactive, but they are contaminated all the same. For every ton of one of the rare earth mineral produced, it's like 40 to 50 tons of the waste. It's a kind of like, I think it's a gypsum waste. And for that same one ton, you get about 4 or 5 tons of the radioactive waste. In Malaysia, it's called water leach purification waste. And that's contained radioactive thorium and uranium, plus toxic heavy metal and other chemicals. And it's stored in very appalling dam that overflow when it rained, and also leaked because of the thin layers of liner that liners use. Sorry, I think I talked too much.
No, that's all really important information. And maybe to get a sense of, the setting that this is happening in, I understand that Kuantan is quite a heavily populated area.
Absolutely, yeah. Not only is populated, it's a high growth area in terms of population and in terms of urbanization. And there are villages, about 50 families, you know, from 12 different kind of estate, housing estate, within the five kilometers diameter from radius from the Lynas plant. And it's also situated very close to the South China Sea, where people have been fishing, you know, for as long as settlement began. Yeah, and fishing and tourism used to be the industry that employed the most number of people, and they still are. But the reputation that Lynas has created has actually affected that. And its wastewater is going into the Balok River, which is a very important spawning ground for a variety of shellfish and seafood. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. And has there been testing done to quantify the contamination that's happening?
Very limited. No this is another problem with Malaysia. Weak governance means that many of the data are not made public, even though the IAEA in 2011 in their report stated very clearly that transparency is critical. But, you know, public do not have access to those data. From the sketchy data that we have accessed and seen in reports, the contamination level is actually very high in seafood and also in the underground water. But each time Linus has categorically denied that it comes from his plant, even though we know from his own EIA report that it's minerals and also it's raw material and also it's mine waste, you know, contain this toxic heavy metal and also the radioactive materials.
Mm. And I know that there has been, you know, a lot of protests ongoing since before the Linus Advanced Mineral Plant sort of even got running. What are the groups within the impacted community focused on at the moment?
Still on the waste. Currently, Linus is proposing to increase the amount of rare earth lanthanide concentrate from Mount Weld to be processed in Malaysia. And that's the one that leaves huge amount of wastewater, radioactive waste, and also gypsum waste. Yeah, I mean, we know that the government will approve Linus's operating license for another 10 years, but there is a public consultation happening, which is really not a consultation. It's more like inviting public to give input as a procedural necessity in order to give it a tick. And from our past experiences doing this kind of public input thing, it has not stopped the government from extending any of the licenses in the past. Yeah, so it's actually quite worrying. Friends of the Earth Malaysia, and also together with a local residential group, Save Malaysia Stop Linus, are planning to advocate through the Australian government to compel Linus to remove the waste back into its mine site in Western Australia, where it has a low-level radioactive waste management plan. That, to the Malaysian, will be the most effective and safest waste disposal, even if we cannot stop the project.
Yeah. What is Linus saying about that
proposal?
Oh, it
won't do it.
Yeah.
I think Linus, well, in its original operating license condition, the condition is that if Linus cannot find a suitable site in Malaysia for its radioactive waste, it will have to remove the waste from the country. So, you know, legally, there is that clause in its agreement, license condition. But Linus has... well, there's a lot of complexity in that Linus has granted a company that is owned by the regent of the state of Pahang, it is kind of, you know, local royalty, to build the so-called permanent disposal facility. They just waste dump that is not really permanent. I have read the environmental impact assessment of that, and it really only say it's technically sound for 20 years. I mean, we're talking about thorium that has got a half-life of 14.5 billion years. I mean, a 20 years lifespan is not good enough. It will subject future generation to the toxic hazard. Yeah, so that's the reason why the Malaysians are wanting it to be removed. Plus, it is so close to the sea, that sea level rise and, you know, wave surges. Mm. It's close to the river, close to human settlement, and so on and so forth. Yeah. And Linus wouldn't do it because it costs them money.
Yes. Well, we've seen the experience of sighting of radioactive waste dumps on this continent is usually imposed on unwilling Aboriginal communities.
Absolutely, yes.
So whatever happens, we know that.
Yeah, agree. But in this case, Linus has already got similar kind of waste that will have to return to its my pit in my world. Not to say that the First Nation people won't be affected, but, you know, so far we have not seen any issues around that. But that will be one of the conditions we would put on Linus to consult with local First Nation community in WA.
You're tuned to The Radioactive Show, produced in the studios of 3CR and broadcast across the continent thanks to the Community Radio Network. Today we're speaking with Liz Downs and Lee Tan about critical minerals and rare earth mining. And maybe this is something that you can jump in on as well, Liz, the way that Australian companies are operating overseas. I know when I was looking into this many years ago, there was international standards, but they were just voluntary. Is that still the case?
Yeah. I mean, there are OECD standards. They're pretty much non-binding. You can embarrass a company in front of its shareholders, but there isn't anything binding, and particularly there's no mechanism in Australia that is binding on how our companies operate overseas, which is how, you know, companies like Linus ended up in Malaysia in the first place, because they have actually stricter mechanisms here in Australia to behave themselves than they do in a lot of other countries, particularly some of the most vulnerable countries in the global south, whose governments are wanting to attract investment. So they've got very slack environmental assessment oversights, very slack investment, low tax demands, that sort of things. So that's why we are seeing so many other companies now, you know, going to, you know, particularly in Africa, for example. We have companies in Namibia, Uganda, Malawi, Tanzania and Madagascar, you know, looking for rare earths. And in Madagascar, we've been in AidWatch, we have been in contact with a civil society group in the past year who are, you know, contending with two mineral sands rare earths projects that absolutely have no social license whatsoever. They've just barged their way in. They've already displaced community members, or one of them has. And I guess another issue is that with this massive push, to start establishing supply chains, particularly around bilateral trade agreements, but just linking companies up to, you know, these supply chains have become part of the military-industrial complex. The Australian government isn't going to want to put oversight on a project that is going to, you know, potentially make a profit, you know, somewhere. So we've got that, you know, this Madagascan project. Australian company has now been bought by a US uranium company called Energy Fuels that is building a massive uranium processing plant in Utah. And they are now investing in buying up Australian rare earths projects, both here and overseas. So you got that element as well.
Yes. Yeah, we actually did a show focused on the Donald Rare Earth Mine.
Yep, yeah. That's the one.
And we spoke with Yolanda Badback from the White Mesa Concern Community and the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe. And they were talking a lot about that long history of opposing that processing mill and the contamination, their land, the air, water, all around there. And I guess that's the thing, the movement of all these materials around the globe also creates risk along those transport routes as well.
Yeah.
Just thinking about the military aspect, and I know that one of our big concerns with the AUKUS Pillar 2 is the fast-tracking of some of these mineral sands projects because of their significance for the critical minerals that are essential for the US military-industrial complex and, of course, these AUKUS submarines. What sort of percentage of rare earths and critical minerals are being used for the military, and how much is going towards this renewable energy boom? Do we have a sense of that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we can say, you know, such a percent pH of rare earth cerium or samarium or whatever is used or scandium. But definitely, for example, the Scud missile, which is one of the most powerful deadly weapons out there, they require scandium, which has a very high tolerant range of temperature. I think it's from minus 600 degrees Celsius to plus 600 degrees Celsius. So they make this mineral, it very essential to make a powerful Scud missile. And of course, there's a whole range of other rare earths. There's 17 of them, and most of them's got very high number of applications in the high-tech sector or digital electronic sector, because of the characteristic of this group of mineral. Yeah, so cerium's used, scandium, and a whole range of rare earths are actually used. And of course, in powerful batteries, you need the neodymium, praseodymium type of rare earth to make the battery small, but, you know, able to contain huge amount of charges in the battery. Yeah, our laptop's getting smaller and smaller, and we can have iPhones and other mobile phones because of this powerful rare earth that, when added to other metals, become, you know, very, very critically important for the digital industry or the electronic industry. So I'm not sure it'd be no percentage. Liz, do you know?
I don't know either, but I mean, yes. I guess in terms of the federal government's focus over the past couple of years, there's certainly been a change. It could be like an admission in what they're delivering to the public about why, you know, it used to be very much a discourse around, you know, green minerals for technologies. But over the past 2 years, that has shifted significantly towards national security and defence. And then we've started to see, so in April, just in the last month, we had Australia and the US signed a massive cooperation agreement on critical minerals and rare earth supply chains. And this was particularly with the Pentagon and also with EXIP, which is the Import-Export Bank of the United States. We know that is going to be about AUKUS. It's going to be, we know what Trump's priorities are. And it says, you know, even now that the Prime Minister's statement or the communique on this is saying, you know, we are wanting to mobilise this capital to bolster national security, basically. So, yeah, that's in the discourse. And we've got under this agreement, it's not just rare earths, it's things like graphite as well and fluorite and nickel, but it's at least half rare earth projects in development in Australia that are being funded under this agreement. So,
yeah, that's very significant. Could you tell us a little bit about the Nolans Bor project? Because my understanding is that the most advanced rare earth mining project that we'll see for the first time a level of processing of the critical minerals on site.
Yeah, I mean, they're planning to build obviously a mine, but also a refinery on site. They're planning to store their radioactive waste on site. They've attracted significantly, they've attracted about $1.25 billion in federal government funding over the past 3 years or so. Several different grants, large grants and small grants. So they are certainly the most heavily funded, you know, in terms of public money. So the second one being Iluka Resources, which is building the Eneabba refinery in Western Australia near Kwinana. And they've also attracted around $1 billion worth of funding as well, or just over. So, yeah, Nolans is interesting because, I mean, they did their environmental impact assessment back in 2018. And, you know, there were concerns raised about what's going to, you know, is radioactive waste storage going to be enough? Is it going to leak? Is it going to get into the waterways? You know, we've got bore water here. We've got water use issues. And, of course, Arafura, because, you know, even then they were kind of like, of course, we can address all of these issues. No worries. And, you know, so there's been very little since in terms of challenging of that stance that, oh, it's going to be perfectly fine. this project's going to go ahead very quickly, I think, and possibly with quite a minimum of certainly a lot of fast-tracking with a minimum of oversight. No, and that's not just the only one. I mean, they've got other exploration projects that are equally probably problematic, but they are just getting money thrown at them at the moment.
Yeah, obviously it's quite a complex area to work in. I'm wondering who are the main groups that are addressing the issues around this, and are there particular campaign asks at this time?
Unfortunately not, actually. Yeah, we've tried to talk to Friends of the Earth and, Jim Green and I kind of touch base on Linus regularly. So far it's been mainly 8Watch doing the research and supporting the local groups with information, advocacy efforts and so on and so forth. Yeah, doing petition, but it's been really difficult to get any of the environmental groups to address the problems because they really are focusing on getting climate actions and renewable energy up, you know, on the agenda. So it's been an uphill battle.
Yeah, and, you know, just to follow on, I think one of the things that needs to happen, I mean, who does that? We're all so drastically underfunded, it's not funny, like all groups, and that's because, I mean, we can't really use, you know, it's like if a project is being marketed as being a green, clean energy project,
yeah.
And of course, that, you know, there's not a lot of funding to watchdog those projects. But one of the areas I think that's really important and what AidWatch is increasingly focusing on is saying, look, it's as much at least about militarisation and defence as it is about clean, green energy. And given that we've got the Australian government with its hands in so many parts of the military-industrial complex and funding, you know, making weapons parts to send to Gaza and stuff like that, you know, this is an issue that we could get, some traction on. But again, it's kind of work and it's you know, funding and all that sort of thing. But it's a direction that we are planning to campaign on as much as we can this year.
Are there particular pressure points that you're seeing emerge, or are you hoping that that will come out of the research phase?
For the Malaysian, they are wanting to crank up some advocacy effort here, you know, jointly with Friends of the Earth Malaysia and maybe Friends of the Earth Japan, because Japan's been the first country that's financed Linus back in 2010 to set up the plant in Malaysia. I mean, internationally, there are space for campaigning, but not sure, you know, like I've been talking with Mina Raman from Friends of the Earth Malaysia for them to actually, get Friends of the Earth International to look into critical minerals, rare earth. At the IAEA level, they really need to make their standards and their guidelines a lot more known and not letting companies get away with it. But then, you know more than I do, IAEA's limitations. So it's been quite difficult, really. Within Malaysia, there's a lot that needs to be done, but it's, you know, when you have a government that's known for its corruption, it is even harder to bring about policy change until the people start to suffer the consequences. But, you know, this kind of radioactive exposure and hazards, kind of a form of slow violence that takes decades, you know, for the cancer and for other chronic diseases to appear. And by then the company would be already gone and living happily ever after, spending their ill-gotten wealth somewhere else. So, it's been a difficult one.
Anything else that either of you would like to add before we wrap up?
I think it's important to keep talking about it. not let it die. Yeah, a silent death. Yeah. I think these are, you know, people are suffering elsewhere, and we need to know the role of the company, of Australian companies, in creating problems and impact that's kind of negatively affecting poor communities somewhere else.
And also domestically, I mean, I think, you know, talking about, like, it's so hard to, you know, we have to find people on the ground to campaign with and support here who, you know, like, are worried about their water. And to learn from examples like Lynas, to be able to say, like, you know, the fact that there already are problems in with Lynas' processing plant in WA. So when we've got five more processing plants online around the continent, I mean, it's going to be, these impacts are going to be seen pretty quickly. And so elevating those voices and elevating those concerns and trying to get more media attention, I think, is really important.
Yep. Getting the supply chain really clean, you know, for renewable energy or clean technology is really critical. And that's something that I think every environmental group should be able to address. Yeah, but they're not really. Yeah.
Thanks so much to Lee Tan and Liz Downs for joining us on the Radioactive Show today. If you want to find out more about the Stop Lynas campaign, you can go to aidwatch.org.au/stop-Lynas. And there's lots more information on the AidWatch website about rare earths and the issues associated. And you will be able to find all the links in our podcast notes at 3cr.org.au/radioactive. Thanks so much to the Nuclear Free Collective at Friends of the Earth Melbourne for their ongoing support, and to the Community Radio Network for getting this program out to community radio stations across the continent. Thanks for listening, and tune in again next week for more news and views on nuclear peace and energy issues.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.